Welcome back, Question Medicine 2021. This is Andrew Bill down here in sunny St. Petersburg, Florida. Another day, another dial, another week, another podcast. You know the deal by now. We're going to get in what I'm getting on. We're going to talk about what I'm reading about. We're going to answer some listener comments. And we are going to discuss something that I probably should have done a long time ago. We are going to discuss a question that I think is really important. We're going to discuss a question that I thought was maybe common knowledge. And then I asked some people that I work with and they had absolutely no idea. So if you have absolutely no idea what I'm talking about, well, then I will break it down for you. I will explain it for you. And there is no need to feel bad because you are not the only one, my friend. No, no. The question is, here is the question, and I will answer it by the end of this podcast. When you hear the statement, when the statement comes out in the news or the newspaper that says, the Pfizer vaccine is 95% effective, when they say the vaccine for COVID-19 is 95% effective, what does that mean? Does that mean that if we vaccinated everyone, that 5% of the people would still get COVID-19? Is that what that means? Or does it mean something different? When they say the vaccine is 95% effective, what do they actually mean? If you know the answer to this, well, then maybe listen to the first 5 minutes and then turn it off the podcast, because the rest of the time I'm going to answer that question for you. If you don't know the answer to this, well, then you're going to want to stay tuned. And with that, without further ado, without any hesitation, without any reservation, it is good to be back. All right, here we go. Andrew Bilt, sunny St. Petersburg, Florida. Let's do this thing, shall we? If you normally just skip through the intro, you say, oh, Andrew doesn't really say anything important in the intro, so I'm just going to skip ahead, then you are going to want to either A, go back and listen, or B, go back and listen, because I ask a very important question in the intro. And if you know the answer to that, well, then I give you credit. I give you props, my friend, because you are one of few, only one of few, because most people, I do not think, and I could be wrong, I've been wrong once or twice before, but I do not think know the answer to that question. Now, speaking of me being wrong, in the buprenorphine podcast, two podcasts ago, around minute 305 to 310, somewhere in there, I say bupropion instead of buprenorphine. 100%, I messed it up. And many of you have either texted me or called me or emailed me or tweeted at me or let me know that I messed it up. And I was going to go back and I was going to fix it. I was going to go back and I was just going to re-say the words. You just take down the old file, put the new file up. And then I thought to myself, no, 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 I could do that. But I am a one-man band. I am only human. I make mistakes. Like all of us, we make mistakes. So I'm just owning up to it and saying, hey, that was my bad. I meant to say buprenorphine, and I had a speako, or a typo, if you will. I just said the wrong word, and that is completely my fault. I could edit it and act like nothing ever happened, but what's the fun in that? And plus, it's kind of fun at this point to see how many people actually catch it, because I knew about it within the first, I don't know, hour of it going up. Somebody messaged me about it, and I could have changed it right away. Most of you then hadn't even listened to it yet, didn't even know it was posted, but I like to keep it up and just see who caught it. And I will say that if I was listening to that, and I did listen to it, actually, I did not catch it that second time around, or even third time around that I listened to it. So good job, way to catching it. Way to pay close attention. And all my Question Medicine listeners that did find it, thank you for Question Medicine. The big part about Question Medicine, the podcast, is that I encourage everyone to question medicine or question what is said in medicine, even if it's said on the Question Medicine podcast. Question everything, even if you hear it on the Questioning Medicine podcast. And with that, there were also a few more questions or comments on that buprenorphine podcast. So I want to address those, and then I want to address where we currently stand with the whole buprenorphine and the X waiver that exists. One of the questions I got, or one of the comments I got, talked to me and said, "Hey, Andrew, I know in the podcast you went ahead and you mentioned opioid abuse disorder, but we use opioid use disorder. I'm just telling you what was said in the paper. I really think it's six one way, half a dozen the other. You know, it's a baker's dozen one way and it's a dozen the other way. It doesn't really matter. I think the whole point here is to let the pharmacist know this is why you are writing for the medication." And speaking of writing for the medication, there were a couple comments that came in that said, "Hey, Andrew, I like that you're talking about buprenorphine. I think this is really great. However, you didn't really talk about the timing of starting the Suboxone. You didn't really talk about the patient can't come in high as a kite and then you just give it to him because then you're going to potentially, I highlight the word potentially, precipitate withdrawal, and we don't want to do that. So the patient already needs to be into some sort of withdrawal before we give them the medication, or else we're going to cause them to be in withdrawal." And you didn't mention anything about that. And yes, you are correct. I didn't mention anything about that. Because ideally, if you just go by the literature, you do need to be in a semi-withdrawal state prior to your first dose. And I thought about mentioning this. I thought about talking about the different withdrawal scales that you can use. And then I realized that although this is all hypothetical and theoretical, it's not exactly a 100% borne out in the studies, literature, and science. It's not 1,000% and nothing ever it is. And I try to keep these podcasts, you know, 20 minutes or so. And if I'd added all that information plus the data that says this may or may not be real, this podcast would have ended up being like an hour long. My goal with that podcast was to get you to think about it. My goal with that podcast was to get it in the back of your brain. I don't suspect that very often, and I could be wrong, that you hear something on Questioning Medicine and immediately the next day you put it into practice, especially something so big as this on a drug that you've never written before. I realize that if you listen to that podcast, you were going to, or hopefully you were going to, go and read about it up to date. You were going to go read about it in some book or journal or article. You were going to Google it. You were going to do a little bit more research than just listening to my 20-minute podcast on Questioning Medicine. So I decided to leave all of that out. But with that being said, yes, you don't necessarily want to start buprenorphine just willy-dilly wham bam as soon as the person is high as a kite. Ideally, yes, you would like them into a little bit of withdrawal already. So then, you know, past the halfway point, halfway being the partial agonist of the mu opioid receptor. So that way, if they're past 50%, then you give them the buprenorphine, well, then you're filling up 50%. So you're kind of giving them a re-bump of their high and prevent them from going to withdrawal. I mean, once again, it's all hypothetical. And I will tell you the data is far from super, super clear on this. I do believe that it happens. I know somebody's going to write me and say, "I take care of these patients all the time. And I know that it happens." I don't disagree with you. I agree that it happens, but it's not 1,000% by any means. And some of the scales that came up with when I started going back of how did they develop these scales? Where did these withdrawal scales come from? Not exact science and not necessarily borne out in just pure opioids. And if it is opioids, you know, is it borne out then in heroin? Is it? It's not a clear cut picture, so I just did include it. And with that being said, we don't really have to worry about it anymore. The reason being is because this whole thing that I talked about with buprenorphine, what the expansion of doing away with the X waiver, the reason that we don't have to do the X waiver, we could have 30 patients under our control, is because it was one of Trump's last actions in office. And I don't want to make this a political conversation, but no matter what you think of Trump, that was a good thing. To expand our access to this medication to help fix the problem that realistically we caused. It was a good thing. And I think almost everyone thought it was a good thing. Almost everyone who is in medicine thinks there is an opioid problem. And everyone thinks that's ever looked at the data, number needed to treat of two, I remind you, thinks that, hey, it would be really nice to fix the opioid problem. Everyone would like to write for a drug with number needed to treat of two if they could and not have to go to an 8-hour course in order to prescribe it, especially when they didn't have to go to an 8-hour course to prescribe the drug to get you hooked on. This was one of the last things that Trump did. However, President Biden administration put a stop to this almost immediately. They reversed this ruling or this signature or this executive order by President Trump and said, no, stop. You actually can't do that. That's no good. We're going to put this on hold. And I thought to myself when this happened, are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? This is one thing that almost everyone in medicine agrees upon, whether they are Republican or Democrat, they agree upon that this was really a good thing that President Trump did. So I had to dig a little deeper, and the findings were interesting, to say the least. You see, the reason that we have this X waiver, which is that 8-hour class that you have to take, is because of the Drug Addiction Treatment Act of 2000. Yes, the Drug Addiction Treatment Acts, DATA, or the DATA 2000 waiver. And this was that physicians may apply for a waiver to prescribe buprenorphine for treatment of opioid addiction or dependence outside of the opioid treatment program. 2000, there you go. The goal of this was maybe to get it back in the hands of primary care providers, but realistically, I'm not actually sure if that was the goal of this when I dug deeper into it. But that's the way it was sold. It was, hey, look at this. You could do an 8-hour course, and now we can have this back in the hands of primary care providers. This will be great for everyone. I'm not sure that that's exactly what they thought, but that's how it was sold. That's how it was spun. But Biden reversed the fact that Trump said, hey, we're going to do away with this. I want primary care doctors, and I want everyone to be able to take care of these people, and I don't want to hinder you from writing for this really great drug. So I'm going to do away with it. Biden reversed it. Why would he reverse it? And I thought to myself, it must be the money. It's always the money. If they say it ain't about the money, well then, Johnny, let me tell you, it's always, always, always all about the money, if you know what I'm saying. But there are two reasons that I think that President Biden reversed this. And that was, number one, confirmation bias. This act, this DATA Act, was written by, the DATA Act was written by Senator Orrin Hatch, Republican, Utah, Senator Carl Levin, Democrat, Michigan, and Senator Joe Biden, Democrat, Delaware. When you wrote the bill that put this into place, you really think it's probably a good bill. And no matter what happens, you want that bill to continue. So if some president before you comes in and says, I'm doing away with this because it's not good for medicine, it's not good for the people. Yes, you may not be able to put your ego aside and say, you know what, this is actually a good thing. You know what, that thing that we did 20 some years ago, we thought was good then, but man, I'm really glad that President Trump did this now. Instead, you say, no. You see what I did 20 years ago? It's still really good now. That's what you would say to yourself. The other thing that I think that happened was President Biden received money from Big Pharma. Oh no, that can't be. But it is. You see, Big Pharma donated $6.3 million to President Biden's campaign compared to only $1.6 million to President Trump's campaign. People that donated to President Biden were people like Thaddeus Burns, the head of government affairs at Merck. Yep, Merck Life Sciences, Big Pharma, in his pocket saying, hey, here's a little bit of money for your campaign. Another person was David Shear. David Shear sits on the board of pharmaceuticals at Aura Pharma and Viro Pharma, which was slammed by the FTC in 2017 because they were delaying generics coming out. They had vancomycin. They didn't want a generic to come out. So then the drug company was proven to delay the release of a generic medication because they didn't want competition. It's these kind of, I'm just going to go ahead and say it, slime balls that were lining the pockets of President Biden. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with President Biden taking the money. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that at all. I'm just saying these people are slime balls. And when they start slipping you a couple thousand, $100,000, $1 million into your pocket, all of a sudden you feel obligated to listen to them. Also, President Biden's plan is to increase insurance coverage for everyone. I'm not here to debate whether that's a good thing or bad thing, but if you're a drug company, you absolutely want that because you need people to have insurance to pay for your really expensive drugs. People can't buy $10, $100,000, billion drugs if they don't have insurance. It's just not possible. No normal human can afford that price. And Trump, in his 4 years of presidency, gave multiple executive orders to affect drug prices nationwide. Executive orders. Some people may think it's crazy. Some people say, man, you should maybe ask other people. No. He went in with a stamp by himself, executive order, boom, done. Biden also believes that drug prices are important, also believes that drug prices are high, but has said and came out and say that he will seek a review board to assess and recommend a reasonable price. If you are a drug company, what would you rather have? Would you rather have a president that does executive order, this is what I believe and this shall be it? Or would you rather have a president that says, I'm going to have a review board, we're going to take a couple years to get this thing figured out, maybe recommend some prices, slowly make some changes? Ooh, you tell me which one you would rather have. I know which one I would rather have, and I will just leave it at that. Now, let's get on to the last question, maybe the most important question, and that is, when they say the COVID-19 vaccine is 95% effective, what do they mean? Does that mean that if every single person in the world got the COVID-19 vaccine, that 5% of people would still develop COVID-19? Is that what that means? I will let you ponder, and then I will answer your question. Well, my question, but the question that was proposed to me, and I realize is maybe not as clear to everyone as I thought that it may or would be. All right, here we go. The COVID-19 vaccine is 95% effective, but what does that mean? I'm going to break it down for you. You see, we're going to talk about the Pfizer vaccine because that's mainly what's talked about. And this was in the New England Journal of Medicine titled Safety and Efficacy of BNT162B2 mRNA COVID-19 Vaccine. This was a randomized placebo-controlled trial. Well, that's pretty good. And in this randomized placebo-controlled trial, you either got BNT162B2, which is the Pfizer vaccine, and that's what I'm going to call it from now on because it's way easier to say the Pfizer vaccine, even though, obviously, if you listen to Question Medicine, you know I don't take money from any drug company. They don't even offer money to me because they probably don't like the things that I have to say. So you're either given the Pfizer vaccine intramuscularly in 30 microgram doses 21 days apart, or you're getting a saline placebo. There was roughly 22,000 people in each group. And if you read the paper, you will read the bottom line, the conclusion. If you just read, and when I say read the paper, I mean if you just read the abstract. If you read the abstract, you will see it says, a two-dose regimen of the Pfizer vaccine conferred 95% protection against COVID-19 in persons 16 years of age or older. There you have it. That's where we get this information. But what does it mean, I ask you? What does it mean? First of all, we have to remember is that everyone in this study that had or came down with COVID-19 had COVID-19, but we do not know if they had sterile immunity. Meaning, if you got COVID-19, even if you got the vaccine, we don't know if that means you had COVID-19 and you were still shedding virus to other people so they could get it, or if you were sterile immunity, meaning you were shedding virus, but there was sterile virus. You couldn't actually spread the COVID-19. You yourself had COVID-19, but you couldn't spread it. From what we know of other viruses and other vaccines, it's almost certain that you could still spread virus to other individuals. Almost certain, but we don't know for sure. We certainly do not know for sure. All we know is that this vaccine seemed to protect you 95% of the time. It protected you from getting COVID-19. And the interesting thing I find is that when we talked about the Dan Mast trial, that Mast trial that was a negative trial, there was a whole bunch of reasons for it. One of the main arguments from all people who believe that COVID is coming the end of the world was, well, this study just shows that masks don't decrease your risk. They don't decrease your risk of getting COVID-19. This shows nothing about giving COVID-19 to other people. Neither do vaccine trials. I mean, if you're going to use that argument for masks because it didn't show what you want it to show, then you have to use the same argument for vaccines. You can't cherry pick what you want to do. That's not how science works. And unfortunately, there are so many people out there that have cherry picked exactly what they wanted to say. And they've said, well, you know, we're going to use this argument for the mask trial, but then we're not going to use that argument for vaccines. That's not how it works, folks. It's science. You got to take the good with the bad. You can't pick and choose. So let me get off my soapbox here and let's get back to this study. 95% effective. What does that mean? Does it mean that if everyone was injected, the entire population, that 5% of the population will still get COVID-19? Is that what that means? Now, this is when it gets good because this is my favorite thing. We are going to break down the real numbers inside this trial and take a look at what it actually means. Because after two vaccines, the events per 1,000 people in 1 year was 73 per 1,000 in the placebo and 3.6 events or positive COVIDs per 1,000 per 1 year. Even though they only did 2 months of follow-up, when you expand that out over 1 year, this is what the numbers look like. So 3.6 events per 1,000 people per 1 year with the actual vaccine. So if you got placebo, you had 73 events per 1,000. And if you got the real thing, you had 3.6, or basically 4 events per 1,000. That is a 95% reduction. Because how do I know this? Well, I took 3.6 and divided it by 73, and that comes out to 5%. So that means 3.6 is 5% of 73. So there was a 95% reduction then in order to go from 73 down to 3.6. That's right, going from 73 events or 73 positives per 1,000 people in 1 year to 3.6 positive COVIDs per 1,000 people at 1 year is a 95% reduction, a 95% relative reduction. In absolute terms, you are going from 7.3% risk per year down to 0.36% events per year. In absolute terms, 7.3 minus 0.3 is a 7% reduction. That's a number needed to treat of around 14. Now, don't get me wrong, that's really good. We don't really have a lot of drugs or a lot of things that we do with numbers needed to treat of 14. You inject 14 people to prevent one person per year for testing positive for COVID-19. That doesn't mean that you're preventing them from getting sick from COVID-19. It doesn't mean you're preventing symptoms from COVID-19. You're just preventing the diagnosis, because that's what they looked at, with COVID-19. Doesn't mean that if you inject every person, only 5% of the population will get COVID-19? No, of course not. It's a relative risk reduction. This is exactly what we talked about in the previous podcast, and here it is again. It's not 95% absolute risk reduction. It doesn't mean everyone's going to get it now, only 5% is going to get it, because everyone's not going to get it. Come on, people. Everyone gets the vaccine, and we still have roughly 4 people out of every 1,000 per year that will come down with COVID-19. And that doesn't sound like a lot. We give the vaccine to everyone, 4 people per 1,000 per year will get COVID-19, until you realize that we have 333 million people in America, which means that this still roughly translates to 1.3 million positive COVID cases every year if everyone gets the COVID-19 vaccine. Now, I don't know if those are going to be symptomatic COVID-19s. I don't know. I'd have no idea. But if you go by the data, if you go by the literature here, it would mean that if everyone got it, like they did in the trial here, then we would have still over a million cases of COVID-19. Yes, there are arguments that if everyone got it, that it would run out but it's a virus. It's going to mutate. That's what viruses do. So you can't really necessarily play the argument there. I'm just saying, if you look at the trial, you look at the data, that's what it means. It doesn't mean that 5% of people are going to get COVID-19. It's going to be about a million, which is still really good. I mean, that's way less than 1% of the population if everyone were to get the vaccine, not 5%. But this is an important detail, because with still 1.3 million people per year testing positive for COVID-19, we have to turn to something I said from the very beginning. We can't care about COVID cases. We can't care about just testing positive for COVID. We have to care about the events from COVID, the mortality, the hospitalizations, the things of badness. Because if we're still having 1.3 million events or 1.3 positive tests every year, that's still a ton. And we're never going to open back up to normal. To recap, the relative reduction of the vaccine is 95%. You go from 73 positive COVID cases per 1,000 each year to 4 positive COVID cases per 1,000 people each year. But in absolute terms, the risk is really 7.3% per year to 0.36% per year. So the absolute difference is 7%. And I got that by taking 7.3 and subtracting 0.3. The media will always stick with a 95% reduction. It sounds so much bigger and so much sexier than a 7% reduction. And they are right when they say it's a 95% reduction, but they should say it's a 95% relative risk reduction because it's really relatively based on your baseline risk. If you're super high risk, well then of getting COVID, well then this will lower your risk of 95%. Let's say you're walking into COVID storms all the time. It's not your risk of having a bad outcome from COVID, say the elderly, it's your risk of getting COVID. So if you work in some sort of field where you're around COVID all the time, well, then this will reduce your risk. But if you are in a field where you just sit in your home all day and you never leave, you're lowering your 95% risk. But if your baseline risk is zero because you never leave your house, well, then 95% relative risk reduction of zero is still a 0% risk. It just sounds better to say 95% risk reduction, although they mean 95% relative risk reduction. In absolute terms, it's a 7% risk reduction. And even if everyone gets vaccinated, we're still going to have over 1 million infections a year. So how would it sound on the news if they said, yes, ladies and gentlemen, step right up, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, children of all ages, especially the elderly in the back, come get a vaccine and it only lowers your risk by 7% in absolute terms. Not a whole lot of people would sign up for that. But a 95% risk reduction, people sign up like crazy, even though they have no idea what it actually means. If you are a provider and you work with other providers, other clinicians, other nurses, I encourage you when you go into the office tomorrow to ask them, hey, I think I heard that the COVID vaccine is 95% effective, right? And then see what they say. And if they say, yeah, that's absolutely right, then you should say, well, does that mean that if we give the vaccine to everyone, 5% of the people will still get COVID-19? And if they say, yeah, absolutely, that's right. Well, then I would say, yeah, absolutely. Share with them this podcast. Knowledge is power. Knowledge is power for everyone. And we all need to question a little bit more medicine. So with that, I will end this podcast as I've ended every one before it. Wait for the music. And until next time, keep the quest and questioning.